This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, just a few days before Stephen Donziger's sentencing, we speak with attorney Martin Garbus.
Martin's up against Chevron Oil Company, one of the largest companies in the world. They're polluting our planet, as we can see by the forest fires, the change of climate. It's a disaster, and they're sending an attorney who fought this to jail.
Professor Marjorie Cohn joins us to talk about a recent attack on our former co-host Michael Ratner for the work he was doing.
Michael brought a lawsuit on behalf of the Muslim prisoners who were in Guantanamo, the offshore prison island that the United States was using to stash Muslim prisoners. They wouldn't give them a lawyer, bring charges against them, or give them a trial. Michael challenged this. Moyne, who attacks him, says that what Michael did prolonged the wars in Southeast Asia.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
By now, anyone living in an urban area of America certainly can see that our nation's homeless problem has grown alarmingly over the past year. Yes, despite half-hearted governmental efforts such as rent moratoriums and partial rent forgiveness programs, the numbers of Americans on the streets just keeps right on getting larger and larger. Currently, 2.5 to 3 million Americans are living on the streets, in shelters, or in transitional housing, with an estimated 7.5 million more who are only that, well, you know, one paycheck away from being homeless. Decades of criminal governmental neglect, runaway rent increases, the lack of low-cost governmental housing, the further impoverishment of poor and working-class American by the policies of the ruling corporate elite have all resulted, as Malcolm X would say, in the chickens having come home to roost. Which, with apologies to Malcolm, I would only say, but at least those chickens have a roost to come home to. In the past, with the homeless confined largely to out-of-the-way and out-of-sight skid rows, we housed Americans could go about our lives rarely coming face-to-face with the reality of this inexcusable situation. But these days, there are small tent cities located way beyond America's traditional skid rows in clear view of the public. In my city and in big cities all across America, these tent cities are now seen all over town, save for in the pricier neighborhoods, of course. You see them under freeway overpasses, in front of closed-up stores, on vacant neighborhood lots, on street corners, and et cetera, et cetera. In Los Angeles, the most glaring and shameful example of our citywide spread of tent cities is seen at the very busy intersection of Wilshire and San Vicente Boulevards, just beyond the UCLA campus, across from the Westwood Veterans Hospital and Federal Building, and bordering LA's very wealthy Brentwood neighborhood. Because on the northeast corner of this intersection is a very large veterans cemetery. And now, on that cemetery's grounds, and on the sidewalk abutting it, there is a tent city of about 100 tents, a great many of them occupied by veterans. The tents on the sidewalk adjacent to the cemetery are uniform, having been provided by a governmental agency, and with each bearing a huge American flag securely affixed to the front of the tent, as though to proudly say, "Hey, look at all we've done for our vets." Think about this scene for a moment, and what it says about America. Our government first sent these homeless vets abroad to places like Iraq and Afghanistan, where they slept in tents as they fought and died for America in one of its endless imperialist wars. And for those vets who made it back alive, but given the great economic inequality in America, have been unable to afford a place to live, the government has now, in its benevolent generosity, provided them not with real housing, but with another tent to live in. A tent on the grounds of the very cemetery where many of them will eventually be buried. One can't help but wonder how many of these homeless vets living in their tents on that veterans cemetery must think, "Well, God bless America. At least I won't have far to travel when I die. They can just dig a hole a few yards from this damn tent and throw me in it." What's wrong with us? What's wrong with the American people? The inexcusably shameful fact that in this super-rich country, so many of our sisters and brothers are unhoused or living in unhealthy squalor is no longer hidden away out of sight, tucked away in some obscure downtown neighborhood, Skid Row, few of us ever ventured into. No, no, it's now right in front of us, right under our noses. How can we bear witness to such an uncivilized, inhumane state of affairs and, well, just drive by, leaving the unhoused to fend for themselves? But in the past, when faced with these injustices, visited upon millions of our sisters and brothers, and with elected officials unwilling to end those injustices, we did not give up. No, we organized massive movements to win our demands for change. The pro-workers' rights movement, the civil rights movement, the child labor law movement, women's suffrage movement, the abolitionist movement itself, and the like. And all of those movements resulted in real progress in securing their demands. And so it's clear to me that the plague of homelessness, too, can be ended, but that our only hope of ending it is to again organize a massive movement to confront our elected officials, to confront them and demand to know why those voters' initiatives, for example, calling for our cities to build housing for the unhoused, have not been honored, demanding they find a way to, well, turn empty office buildings into housing for the unhoused, demand that, as in my city, where there are 10,000 vacant houses under the control of the city, the homeless be allowed to move into those vacant houses, and demanding, too, that the federal government once again build low-cost government housing. In short, a movement that stays in the government's face and stays in the streets until our unhoused sisters and brothers finally have roofs over their heads. Across America today, a great many dedicated activists and organizations have been for years and years working tirelessly on behalf of the unhoused. But they can't hope to win the day unless they are joined by massive more numbers of caring and determined Americans. So please, locate the advocates and organizations fighting for the unhoused in your community and offer them some help. Because if these dedicated activists and advocates for the unhoused don't succeed, it won't be their fault. It will be the fault of the rest of us who drive by our nation's growing numbers of tent cities every day and do nothing but shake our heads sadly and say, gosh, look at that. Look at those poor souls. Isn't it awful? This has been Jim Lafferty with this Law and Disorder editorial.
Attorney Stephen Donziger was recently found guilty of 6 criminal contempt charges for refusing to turn over confidential electronic communications in his case against Chevron Oil. Listeners will recall that Stephen has been embroiled in a decades-long fight over Chevron's devastation of an area in the Amazon rainforest the size of Rhode Island. In a 225-page judgment, Judge Preska said that Stephen had, quote, repeatedly and willfully defied court orders, adding that it's time to pay the piper, with Stephen facing 6 months in jail. It's now been 2 years since Stephen has been wearing a monitoring bracelet and under house arrest in his New York City apartment. He said he expected the decision and he'll appeal it. In 2016, U.S. Judge Lewis Kaplan granted Chevron seizure of Stephen's laptop and phone. When Stephen appealed, he was slapped with the contempt charges and placed under house arrest. Preska's judgment explicitly denies that the lawyer has been the victim of a conspiracy, however. Quote, contrary to Mr. Donziger's assertion that his conviction was preordained, the court finds him guilty on each count for one reason and one reason only. Mr. Donziger did that with which he is charged, period. Joining us again is attorney Martin Garbus, who has represented Nelson Mandela, Daniel Ellsberg, and Cesar Chavez, and has worked in Rwanda, China, and the Soviet Union, among many other countries. Marty, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Marty, was there any aspect of Judge Loretta Preska's judgment that surprised the legal team and Stephen?
No, I was not surprised by any aspect of Judge Preska's decision. I'm surprised surprised to some extent that she took 225 pages to try and justify it. I think that's probably the longest decision ever written in a petty offense case, but the fact of the conviction on the six counts did not surprise me. She came in determined to do that, and you know, and then then we go to sentencing on October 1, and it would not surprise me if she hits Steve with the maximum and doesn't give him credit for the 2 years of house arrest.
Marty, if you were a law professor, and you've been a law professor at Columbia and Yale, how would you teach the facts of the Stephen Danziger case to your class?
Well, I think one of the important things is we understand the difference, let's say, between Clarence Thomas and Ruth Ginsburg. We understand where their politics differ. When you get to the trial level and you get judges at the trial level, one doesn't appreciate the difference between how particular judges can find facts. If this case were before, let's say, Jack Weinstein or Jed Rakoff, the case would be thrown out in a minute. I think an important thing to learn is the difference in the way that judges find facts, and you can find the same kind of differences in the fact-finding process as you can, you know, later on when we try and say this is a liberal judge or a conservative judge. So Preska, who is a member of the Federalist Society and speaks there a good deal, has found facts which justify her conclusion. As I said, I think most other federal judges would have tossed the case.
Marty, I understand that Stephen's sentencing is a few days after this program airs, October 1st. Do you expect that the judge will order him to go to jail, or will he stay under continued house arrest, which, as a reminder to our listeners, it's been 2 years he's been wearing an ankle bracelet in his home?
I think the judge will sentence him to jail, but give us time to go to the Second Circuit to get a stay. So my judgment would be, basically, she will sentence him to jail, and that she will say go to jail, let's say, in 2 weeks, and during that time, we can go to the Second Circuit and get a stay. What's amazing about the Second Circuit is I have been up there on some of the Danziger arguments, and when I watch the arguments, I have not argued any of them, it's been other lawyers, I've always thought there was a great deal of Danziger sympathy. But then the decisions come out not sympathetic to Danziger. I know the Second Circuit will not send him to jail. I don't know how the Second Circuit will ultimately deal with the Preska decision. But being confined to your house for 2 years, I mean, it's not jail, but it's awful. He has a young child in the house. He has a wife in the house. He can't get out of the house. So, like, the entire summer, he's nailed to the house, and except for legal meetings or some other small stuff. So, I mean, house arrest is serious business. Now, why they put a guy like Danziger under house arrest? You know, he recently had this Trump friend, Barack, I forget the name, a man who has endless millions of dollars, could buy his way in and out of any country, can buy planes, etc. I mean, he could leave in a second, and yet they let him walk around. So the whole question of putting someone like Danziger with a wife and a child and a living that he has to earn is just, it's really remarkable, and it's anger and fury. And I think that the way Chevron has handled this has been remarkably effective in its own way, except that the public is becoming aware of it. There are people starting to speak up at stockholder meetings about what's being done to Danziger. But nonetheless, what you have here is a, you know, Chevron early on said they wanted to demonize Danziger and make him an example so that other lawyers would not jump in and try and what Danziger did. And I think to some extent, you know, here's Steve. He went on this extraordinary journey decades ago, starting to, you know, we're all lawyers. It's very, very difficult to do what he did. He did it fundamentally alone. He had help, of course, but basically he was the guiding person. He does this extraordinary achievement. He gets that judgment, and then he comes into New York, and he litigates very complicated questions. I mean, he's been extraordinarily creative, extraordinarily imaginative, and at the moment he's facing a jail sentence, has been disbarred, and owes close to $1 million to Chevron. So it's really, it's quite extraordinary.
Attorney Martin Garvis, you recently wrote a letter to Judge Loretta Preska. Tell our listeners, please, what you wrote to her.
Well, I have represented other people. Of course, I've read. And I was looking at what Danziger did, his creativity, his courage. If you're going to do a 20, 30-year struggle, as he is doing, and he's doing it in large part with pro bono lawyers. Now, one of the things about he's had dedicated, skilled, committed pro bono lawyers. Ron Kuby has been that wonderful lawyer. But when you go up against the endless millions of dollars, in other words, allegedly Chevron's budget for the case has been $10 million, you ultimately get worn down. You ultimately make mistakes. I think that if Danziger had fully committed lawyers who could match in firepower Chevron, different decisions would have been made, and he would not be facing the kind of thing he's facing now. Now, does it rise to a Sixth Amendment deprivation? No. But, for example, myself, I got in 2 years ago. I had nothing to do with the Kaplan case. I had to learn it and read it, and certainly don't know it as well as the Chevron people. Ron Kuby is the same thing. We both came in at a certain point late in the game. And during the course of the 10, 15 years of litigation, Steve went from lawyer to lawyer. And it's a terrible, terrible way to litigate. And, you know, the files in this case are roomfuls of documents. I remember years ago when I was involved with the Cuban Five, and Lenny Weinglass had litigated the case for 10 years, how difficult it is to come in and learn all of the facts. So I think that's one of the issues. The other issue is, I was sitting with, let's say, Dan Ellsberg. Dan came to me years ago, and he said, these are the papers, I want to publish them. I said, Dan, and he said, it's going to end the war in Vietnam, or help end the war in Vietnam. I looked at the law, and I said, Dan, you're going to go to jail for life. And I doubt that it's going to end the war in Vietnam. Well, notwithstanding my advice, Dan did distribute the papers, and he did stand trial. And ultimately, of course, he won. But I think of people like that. I've represented Nelson Mandela, other people, Chavez, so-and-so, people who make decisions about their lives, as Danziger did, knowing that they don't know the end of the road. It's not like, you know, you and I have walked into courtrooms and we've represented this person or that person in a New York court or in a federal court or some other place, and we basically have a game plan. There was no game plan for Danziger. He started this thing in Ecuador decades ago and has been facing, as I said, over $10 billion of lawyer's time, and he's had to go from lawyer to lawyer. I honestly believe that if any of us had been with him at the beginning until the end, You would never be facing these criminal problems. Never. Does that rise to a Sixth Amendment defect? I don't think so.
Please talk about the grounds for an appeal, Marty.
Well, one of the amazing things in the case is how the case gets started. And this is, I think, the major ground for the appeal. The way the case gets started, the criminal case, Kaplan decides that there should be a criminal prosecution. He goes to the U.S. Attorney Berman. Berman says no. Berman says, I will not prosecute. Now, under the law, there's a provision where if the U.S. Attorney says no, then a trial judge can go and get a private lawyer. Those provisions of law were basically put into effect because there might be corruption in the U.S. Attorney's office. And that gave the judge, who wanted a prosecution, another option. The U.S. Attorney in the Southern District, Jeffrey Berman, was not corrupt. Jeffrey Berman, as you remember, was forced out by Trump and by Barr. We don't know, we've tried to find out, whether the Donziger case was one of the reasons why Jeffrey Berman was forced out. And we did a great deal of attempted discovery, all of which failed. So then Kaplan appoints a law firm which had previously represented Chevron. He appoints a law firm that is powerful in the oil and gas industry. He appoints a law firm that wants to continue to get business from the oil and gas industry. He appoints a law firm which then cuts its fees so that it can get the business. Now, the motivations and independence of a lawyer previously paid by Chevron who wants Chevron's business is very different than the motivation of an independent U.S. attorney. The second thing he does, or the third thing he does, he then is supposed to appoint a judge by the wheel. In other words, it's supposed to be a random appointment. He puts the name in, and the wheel gives him a judge. He didn't do the wheel. He went straight to Judge Preska, a member of the Federalist Society, a good friend of the prosecute lawyer Rita Glavin, who's ultimately chosen to be the prosecutor. So instead of an independent judge and an independent prosecutor, you have this fact pattern. Now, of course, all this was brought to Preska's attention, and we asked her endless times to recuse herself. She refused to do it. I have never seen a case in American legal history where you have a judge like Kaplan appoint a lawyer who previously represented, let's say, Chevron, the prosecutor in the case, and then he appoints his own judge. So it's like its own legal system. That, to me, is the basis for review that we have. Now, the next question is, if you have a lawyer, let's say like Rita Glavin, who was appointed, who had been working for Chevron, who is she responsible to? Who supervises her decisions? And the answer in this case is no one. And we have asked the U.S. Attorney, and we have asked the Department of Justice, and they concede that no one overlooks Rita Glavin or supervises her. So if she wants to put in a bill for X dollars, if she wants to do legal strategy of Y, she can do it. In other words, the U.S. Attorney who's prosecuting a case doesn't have a financial motive to do this or that. Here, the lawyer who's appointed has a financial motive as well as a professional motive. If this prosecution succeeds, and it has thus far, it's a star in the cap of Rita Glavin and the law firm that had been working with her in prosecuting this case. So even as I describe it to most people who will be listening to this, they will say, it's so hard to believe. that this is a criminal prosecution where a former Chevron lawyer is doing it before a judge who has Chevron sympathies, but deliberately done that way by Kaplan. It's totally improper. We raised all these issues. We got nowhere.
Marty, is the same legal team representing Stephen on the appeal?
No. He has brought in a different legal team, two lawyers named from a law firm, Washington law firm, who are very competent appellate lawyers, along with Stephen Vladeck, a very well-known constitutional lawyer from Texas. And they will be dealing with the briefs, and they will be dealing with the appeal. I think it's fair to say, you know, Ron has spent 2 years pro bono, and he's been wonderful, wonderful. But I think that you have new people coming in. Steve has raised money, some money for them. He needs to raise more money. And, you know, they have a law firm where they have substantial resources that Ron did not have, that I did not have.
Marty, in our few remaining minutes, how do you think Stephen will be remembered decades from now?
I think I would like him not to be remembered as a victim. I would like him to be remembered as someone who was creative, singular, achieved a result, and he was hijacked by a legal system. We will not get him undisbarred. Now, normally, there was a man named John Horan. He was appointed by the Bar Association to consider whether Steveland's permanent disbarment should be reduced. And he said it should. And he had a hearing. Steve testified. And he said that Steve should be reinstated. The Bar Association ultimately moved against that, and the Bar Association ultimately got Horan's judgment overturned, the same man that they appointed. So, you know, the role of the Bar Association in this, the tentacles of Chevron are extraordinarily powerful. Rudy Giuliani had represented them. Gibson Dunn represents them. They were very close to Christie, Randy Mastro, the former deputy mayor to Rudy Giuliani. And again, Berman is ultimately fired. Berman is the U.S. attorney who refused to prosecute Danziger. He also refused to prosecute, he also refused to defend Trump's friends and prosecute Trump's enemies. So he was fired by Trump and Barr. The role of the Danziger case is not something, well, we know he was fired. He was fired because of things that he did. Do I have a specific piece of paper that says the Danziger case was part of that firing? No. We have been unable to get any discovery. Now, I've had cases previously like this, before Orrin Judd, where we got discovery to see whether or not there was a claim here of improper prosecution. And in that case, before Orrin Judd, we won. Here we couldn't get the information from Preska. She really sealed the vault. You could not get anything from her. It really is a kangaroo court.
Marty, what message does Preska's decision send to other environmental lawyers?
It sends the decision that you are in trouble. That if you try and fight the Chevrons, the Exxons of the world, that you're in trouble. Now, everybody recognizes you have 68 Nobel Prize winners who have come in on Steve's side. Amnesty has come in on Steve's side. Many other organizations have come in on Steve's side. Everybody recognizes this case goes far beyond Steve Danziger. It goes to all of the environmental issues that we're dealing with in our lifetime. So at the same time that you see climate, the environment, blazing across our culture with fires and drownings and stuff, you recognize. By the way, I just want to take one aside. I want to commend Michael. I don't know if you were involved in it, in defending Michael Ratner, who was wrongfully attacked in the New York Review. And Michael has a wonderful piece in the Los Angeles Progressive about a wonderful, wonderful lawyer, Michael Ratner. And I commend that to your listeners.
Well, thank you, Marty. We'll post that piece on our website. One last question, Marty. Remind our listeners where they can get updates on this case and what action they can take to help Stephen.
Well, there will be demonstrations on October 1st. There will be a press conferences on October 1st. We expect, at the trial, we had hundreds of people. I suspect that the conviction will even have more. Court starts at 10, there will be a press conference at 9, and then there will be one after the court. People turnout is very, very significant. We've learned that the way you change a culture is through organization and people turnout. And I ask as many of your viewers or listeners as I can to come down October 1 and be counted.
I hope that we'll see a lot of our listeners at the courthouse on October 1st, 10 o'clock. It's at 500 Pearl Street, room 506. We'll see you then, and thank you for your support. And Marty, thank you very much for all the great work you've been doing on this case.
Thank you very much for having me on, and thank you very much for allowing me to present Steve's position and the position of all lawyers who want to beat down the Exxons and the Chevrons.
You take it easy, Marty. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Controversy was ignited 2 weeks ago when the New York Review of Books published an article by Yale law professor Samuel Moyne. The article singled out human rights attorney Michael Ratner, the co-founder of Law and Disorder Radio. Ratner was the longtime president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. He died 5 years ago. Professor Moyne uses him as a whipping boy to support his bizarre theory that punishing war crimes prolonged the wars in the Middle East by making them more palatable. Professor Moyne disingenuously claims that enforcing the conventions against torture and opposing illegal war are mutually exclusive. Moyne's book, Humane, How the United States Abandoned Peace and Reinvented War, was recently published. It was a chapter from this book that appeared in the New York Review of Books attacking Michael. Moyne makes the false and astonishing claim that, quote, no one perhaps has done more than Ratner to enable a novel sanitized version of permanent war. In defense of Michael Ratner, we speak today with Marjorie Cohn. She's a former criminal law defense attorney and a professor emeritus at the Thomas Jefferson School of Law. She was the past president of the National Lawyers Guild and is a member of the Bureau of the International Association of Democratic Lawyers. Professor Cohn has published 4 books about the war on terror. Last week, she had published an article in the prestigious online magazine Jurist titled Samuel Moyne's Unprincipled Attack on Human Rights Giant Michael Ratner is Shameful.
Marjorie Cohn, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me, Heidi and Michael.
Marjorie, what is the law that stops countries from initiating aggressive war?
The United Nations Charter, which is the supreme treaty of all treaties and is actually part of U.S. law under the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution that says all treaties shall be the supreme law of the land, so it's not just international law, it's also U.S. domestic law. And the UN Charter mandates that countries resolve their disputes peacefully, and no country can use military force against another country unless it's acting in self-defense or the Security Council approves it. And the Charter actually defines aggression as the use of armed force by a state against the sovereignty, territorial integrity, or political independence of another state, or in any other manner inconsistent with the Charter of the United States. I'm sorry, the United Nations.
What's the law in America and internationally on the legality of torture?
Torture is never legal. The Convention Against Torture and Other Cruel, Inhuman, or Degrading Treatment or Punishment, another treaty the U.S. has ratified, making it part of U.S. domestic law, says very specifically, no exceptional circumstances whatsoever, including a state of war, can ever be used as a justification for torture. It's an absolute prohibition. The Geneva Conventions, to which the United States is also a party, classifies torture as a war crime. And then the U.S. has two federal statutes, the torture statute, which makes it a felony, punishable by death in some instances, to torture people in other countries. It doesn't, unfortunately, apply in this country, where torture is all too prevalent in the prisons and by police on the streets when they encounter people of color. But also, the U.S. has a federal statute called the War Crimes Statute, and that also defines torture as a war crime and makes it a felony.
I have to interject that I wish I had had you as a law professor. You are so clear in presenting the laws. So I'm going to ask now, what is habeas corpus and what is the United States law on this ancient concept?
Well, habeas corpus goes back to 1215, to the Magna Carta, and it is a very basic right. It's the only individual right in the Constitution before the Bill of Rights amended the Constitution later. But it's a really basic right that someone who is being held or detained has a right to go before a judge and demand to know why, what the legal grounds are for holding him or her. And the suspension clause in the U.S. Constitution says that the writ of habeas corpus shall not be suspended except in cases of rebellion or invasion when the public safety may demand it. And you don't see any time that we have been invaded or there's an armed rebellion in this country, even actually for a short time, Abraham Lincoln suspended the writ of habeas corpus, and many people said that was illegal because only Congress has the power to suspend the writ of habeas corpus.
I just wanted to add here that if we don't have habeas corpus and there's a secret prison, Michael Ratner used to always say that that would lead inevitably to torture because nobody would know what they're doing to these people. But my question to you, Marjorie, is what did Michael and the Center for Constitutional Rights do to protect habeas corpus when the Bush-Cheney government threw it overboard regarding Muslim prisoners on its offshore prison island in Guantanamo, Cuba?
Well, that's a good question, as are all these questions. And the Bush administration located the Guantanamo, well, they actually sent nearly 800 men and boys to this secret prison in Guantanamo to try to keep it from, keep them from coming into U.S. courts and filing petitions for habeas corpus and saying, why am I being held? I mean, many of them were held in indefinite detention and never charged with any crime. And so in 2004, Michael Ratner and the Center for Constitutional Rights brought the case of Rasul versus Bush, and the Supreme Court actually agreed with them and upheld the right of people detained as enemy combatants at Guantanamo to have their petitions for habeas corpus heard by U.S. courts. The Bush administration was arguing that, well, the detainees are being held on Cuban soil. They have no right of access to U.S. federal courts to challenge their confinement. But the Supreme Court held that the United States exercises complete jurisdiction and control over the Guantanamo Bay prison. And as Justice John Paul Stevens wrote for the majority in Rasul versus Bush, aliens held at the base, no less than American citizens, are entitled to invoke the federal court's authority under the federal habeas corpus statute. And Michael Ratner, who wrote a chapter in a collection that I published called The United States and Torture, Interrogation, Incarceration, and Abuse, wrote, and I quote Michael, "We went into court with a very straightforward proposition that habeas corpus meant every single person detained has a right to go into court and say to the government, tell me why you are detaining me and give me the legal justification," unquote. And fortunately, and astoundingly, the Supreme Court agreed with Michael Ratner, Joseph Margulies, the lead counsel in Rasul, and the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Now, Marjorie, you lead us to an issue that really hits home for Law and Disorder. Who is Professor Samuel Moyne, and what does he accuse Michael Ratner of doing?
Samuel Moyne is a Yale law professor. He's never practiced law, which is very clear when you read his book. He comes up with a bizarre theory that punishing war crimes prolongs war by making it more palatable. So Moyne disingenuously claims that enforcing the Geneva Conventions, which protect against war crimes, torture, indefinite detention, massacring civilians. So Moyne claims that enforcing the Geneva Conventions and opposing illegal wars are mutually exclusive. You can't do both at once. But I really loved Dexter Filkin's quote in The New Yorker, where he wrote, "Moyne's logic would favor incinerating entire cities, Tokyo style, if the resulting spectacles of agony led more people to oppose American power." And in his polemic, Moyne makes the false and astounding claim that, quote, "no one perhaps has done more than Ratner to enable a novel, sanitized version of permanent war," unquote. And without a shred of evidence, Moyne callously alleges that Ratner, quote, "laundered the inhumanity of war that thus became endless, legal, and humane," unquote. Well, Moyne has apparently never visited Guantanamo, which many people have called a concentration camp, where prisoners were ruthlessly tortured and held for years without charges. And the torture that went on at Guantanamo and in Iraq and Afghanistan, for that matter, was documented in a 6,700-page report of the Select Senate Committee on Intelligence. And they only released a 500-page summary, which I read, which made your stomach turn. But although Barack Obama did end Bush's torture program, prisoners at Guantanamo continued to be violently force-fed on Obama's watch, and force-feeding constitutes torture.
Why does Michael write in the chapter in your book that, quote, "preventive detention is a line that should never be crossed"?
Well, he also writes, and this is in the United States and Torture book as well, he writes that a central aspect of human liberty that has taken centuries to win is that no person shall be imprisoned unless he or she is charged and tried. These are the words of Michael Ratner. Quote, "if you can take away those rights and simply grab someone by the scruff of the neck and throw them into some offshore penal colony because they are non-citizen Muslims, those deprivations of rights will be employed against all. This is the power of a police state and not a democracy."
Marjorie, Moyne also faults Michael for not suing to stop the Bush-Cheney administration's attacks on Afghanistan and Iraq. He does this in order to bolster his argument that in his defense of habeas corpus, Michael prolonged America's foreign wars. How do you appreciate this claim?
Well, Joe Margulies, who once again was the lead counsel in Rasul and worked with Michael and CCR, told me, quote, the implication that Rasul somehow enabled the forever wars is simply incorrect. Because of the war in Afghanistan, the first phase of the war on terror was fought on the ground, which predictably led to the U.S. capture and interrogate to capture and interrogate a great many prisoners. But this phase of the war has long since been supplanted by an aspiration to what the NSA calls information dominance. More than anything, the war on terror is now a war of continuous global surveillance, followed episodically by drone strikes. It is a war about signals more than soldiers. And then this is the important sentence. Nothing in Rasul, Margulies told me, or any of the detention litigation has the slightest effect on this new phase. Now, keep in mind that three different lawyers filed lawsuits challenging the legality of the Iraq War, and three different federal courts of appeals threw them out of court. One of them tried to challenge the war before it started, before Bush invaded Afghanistan, and that was by active duty soldiers and families and other people, and the court said, oh no, any harm that you might suffer from this war is speculative. So they threw that suit out of court. And then there were two other lawsuits, the one that was brought on behalf of Congress members, and that one also they said they threw that out of court, saying you can't show any harm from this illegal war. And then the third suit was brought by an Iraqi woman against Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld and Rice and all the rest of the war criminals in the Bush administration. And that was thrown out of court because they said that these people had immunity, governmental immunity from suit. So even if Michael had spent his time filing suit against the war, which was done by other lawyers, he would have lost, but he did win when he filed this lawsuit in Rasul, protecting, as I said, one of the most, if not the most important right, the only individual right in the original Constitution, the right to be brought before a judge to ask the government why they are holding you, and that is the writ of habeas corpus.
Is opposing war and opposing torture in that war at odds with one another? Can't you oppose both? Didn't Michael Ratner oppose both?
He certainly did, and they are not mutually exclusive. As I said, the UN Charter says that a war of aggression is unlawful, and the Geneva Conventions and the Hague Conventions and the protocols to Geneva make up what we call international humanitarian law, and that is the prohibition against torture, against indefinite detention, against killing civilians. Certainly, both can be opposed at once. They are not mutually exclusive. And indeed, Michael Ratner was a longtime opponent of illegal U.S. wars. He attempted to enforce the War Powers Resolution in 1982 after Reagan sent, quote, military advisors, unquote, to El Salvador. Ratner sued George H.W. Bush, albeit unsuccessfully, to require congressional authorization for the first Gulf War. In 1991, Ratner organized a war crimes tribunal and condemned U.S. aggression, which the Nuremberg Tribunal called the supreme international crime. In 1999, Ratner condemned the U.S.-led NATO bombing of Kosovo as a crime of aggression. In 2001, Ratner and Jules LaBelle, a University of Pittsburgh law professor, wrote in Jurist that Bush's war plan in Afghanistan violated international law, and shortly thereafter, Ratner told a meeting of the National Lawyers Guild, and of course he was a past president, as you know, that the 9/11 attacks were not acts of war, but rather crimes against humanity. In 2002, Ratner and his colleagues at CCR wrote in the New York Times that the prohibition on aggression constitutes a fundamental norm of international law and can be violated by no nation. In 2006, Ratner gave the keynote address at an International Commission of Inquiry on the Bush administration's crimes against humanity and war crimes, including the illegality of the Iraq War. I was there and also presented testimony, by the way. And in 2007, Ratner wrote a testimonial for my book, Cowboy Republic, Six Ways the Bush Gang Has Defied the Law. He wrote, quote, from an illegal, aggressive war in Iraq to torture, Here it all is, the six major ways the Bush administration has made America an outlaw state.
That's a lot of powerful material there. Marjorie, let's go to the Rome Statute. What is it? And why do you think Moyne isn't familiar with the statute?
Well, it's the Rome Statute established the International Criminal Court. And Moyne, in his book called Humane, which is a real oxymoron, How the United States Abandoned Peace and Reinvented War, Moyne falsely, first of all, he only mentions the International Criminal Court once, which is proof positive, I would say exhibit A, that Moyne's never practiced law, because if he's talking about ending wars and suing to prevent wars and encouraging prosecutors to sue to prevent wars, the International Criminal Court and the Rome Statute should have been mentioned and analyzed all throughout his book. He mentions it once, and he misstates it. The central premise he misstates, and this is a Yale law professor, and he ought to be ashamed. Moyne wrote in his book that the International Criminal Court fulfilled the legacy of Nuremberg except in omitting its signature accomplishment of criminalizing illegal war itself, unquote. Well, if Moyne had taken the time to read the Rome Statute, he would see that one of the four crimes punished under the statute is the crime of aggression. The crimes are war crimes, crimes against humanity, genocide, and the crime of aggression. And the crime of aggression was defined by the state's parties, the parties to the Rome Statute, as the planning, preparation, initiation, or execution by a person in a position effectively to exercise control over or to direct the political or military action of a state, of an act of aggression, which by its character, gravity, and scale constitutes a manifest violation of the Charter of the United Nations, unquote. That's the Rome Statute. But the International Criminal Court couldn't prosecute the crime of aggression when Ratner was still alive because the aggression amendments didn't come into force until 2018, 2 years after Ratner died. Moreover, neither Iraq, Afghanistan, nor the United States have ratified the amendments, making it impossible to punish aggression unless the UN Security Council so directs, and with the U.S. veto on the Council, that will not happen. That analysis that I just laid out, Heidi and Mike, should have been in Moyne's book. It should have been central in Moyne's book, and yet the one time he mentioned in passing the International Criminal Court, never mentioned the Rome Statute, by the way, he miscited the International Criminal Court's Rome Statute.
What could have stopped the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan? It's a political situation, isn't it? It's not a legal one. After all, millions of people demonstrated against the Iraq war around the world, and this was ignored by Bush and Cheney.
You're right. There was one day in February of 2003 where there were, I don't know, some 13 million people in the streets. I was in London, and you couldn't even see. It was a sea of people. Unfortunately, that opposition was not sustained, and once Bush invaded Iraq, that anti-war movement really dissipated. The Bush administration capitalized on 9/11 in a shameful way to invade Iraq illegally. There was absolutely no basis. It was not self-defense, and they lied. They lied about weapons of mass destruction and about the so-called mushroom cloud. So people wanted revenge afterwards. After 9/11, and that led to the invasion of Afghanistan, and a couple of years later, the Iraq War. But as I said before, the attacks of 9/11 were not armed attacks by another state, which would authorize self-defense. They were crimes against humanity and should have been treated as such.
Marjorie, you know better than most how the war on terror has shifted from boots on the ground to drones in the air. Did anything in Michael Ratner's detention litigation have the slightest effect on this newer phase in the U.S. wars?
Absolutely not. And that's what Joe Margulies said in his marvelous quote. if anything sanitized, and I use sanitized in quotes because that's what Moyne accuses Ratner of having done, if anything sanitized war, it was the drones, which were not developed because of any litigation that Michael and CCR engaged in. They were developed to enrich defense contractors and to prevent U.S. pilots from being killed because they operate the joystick remotely, because the U.S. government learned from Vietnam that Americans don't like to see other Americans coming back in body bags. But nevertheless, these so-called drone pilots still suffer from PTSD in the course of killing innumerable numbers of civilians.
Marjorie, we've got time for one last question. Unfortunately, we're running down the clock, but I wanted to ask you, why do you think this controversy with Moyne is important outside of a handful of intellectuals and human rights attorneys?
Well, Michael, because if anyone listens to Moyne, and he is a Yale law professor, the logical extension of Moyne's bizarre theory is that you turn the other way. You don't represent clients who have been tortured or families of civilians that have been slaughtered or people who are being indefinitely detained. And so this has widespread ramifications, and when you have people making policy and judges on courts, they tend to quote law professors, and particularly Yale law professors. So it's a very, very dangerous, dangerous theory, and it needs to be debunked in every possible way and in every possible venue, and I'm so glad that you're having this program today.
Marjorie, how can listeners learn more about your work and read your many writings?
Well, they are collected at my website, marjoriecohn.com, and it has all my articles and video and radio interviews, and also my books are there as well. But also Truth Out, I write about 3 articles a month for truthout.org, so you can also go to Truth Out, and my column is known as Human Rights and Global Wrongs. That's the general category. And then I write about things like we're talking about here and drones and torture. In fact, I have another piece about drones and the war crimes that Biden committed when he killed 10 civilians in Afghanistan a few weeks ago, coming out later this week.
Marjorie, it's always a delight to have you on Law & Disorder, so we hope we can call on you for the next political crisis.
Thanks so much.
Marjorie Cohn, thank you very much for being on Law & Disorder. You take it easy.
Thanks. You too, Michael.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.